Tuesday, November 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden urges Americans not to worry too much about the COVID Omicron variant.
We'll have to face this new threat just as we face those that come before it.
Negotiators in Vienna resume talks over reviving Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers.
There is a sense of urgency in putting an end to the suffering of the Iranian people.
And thousands of migrants continue to wait in Belarus to enter the European Union through Poland. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Facing another challenge in his effort to contain the coronavirus pandemic, President Biden is urging Americans not to worry too much about the Omicron variant. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sigal Magani reports.
The president says the variant will keep spreading and inevitably reach the U.S.
This variant is a cause for concern,
but not a cause for panic.
We'll have to face this new threat just as we face those that come before it.
He's renewing calls for the roughly 80 million unvaccinated Americans ages 5 and older to get their shots, and for those who already have to get boosters. The president's also urging a return to indoor mask wearing in public places. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
Pfizer's chief executive officer, Albert Bourla, told CNBC Monday that the company's new antiviral drug, Paxlovid, is expected to be effective against the Omicron variant of COVID-19. Pfizer applied for emergency authorization of Paxlovid last week after reporting data showing it was 89% effective at preventing hospitalization or death in at-risk people.
The good news when it comes to our treatment, it is that was designed with that in mind, with the fact that most mutations are coming in the spike, so the mechanism of action that we're having is not related with the spike. So that gives me very, very high level of confidence that the treatment will not be affected, our oral treatment will not be affected by this virus. When it comes to the vaccine, it remains to be seen. I don't think that the result will be the vaccines don't protect. I think the results could be, which we don't know yet, that the vaccines protect less. Which means that if the vaccines protect less, it is that we need to create a new vaccine. Already we started Friday. Friday we made our first DNA template, which is the first part of the manufacturing, of the development process of a new vaccine. And we have made multiple times clear that we will be able to have a vaccine in less than 100 days. In fact, we have already two vaccines built in less than 100 days. We built one for Delta that we didn't know to use, because the current vaccine is very effective against Delta, and we built one for Beta, which also we didn't have to use. So we will build one at risk right now for Omicron that will be used only in case we need it, if we see that the current one doesn't work. So I'm very, very, very confident that this drug works for all known mutations, including the Omicron one. But we are working on follow-up drugs for the eventual case that maybe a resistance is developed.
That's Pfizer's chief executive officer, Albert Bourla. At least 5 million people have had their lives cut short by COVID-19. The best defense against the virus is a vaccine, and since the outbreak of the pandemic, scientists have focused on developing them. VOA's Carol Pearson explains some of the different approaches to making effective vaccines.
Some people think if you get sick after being vaccinated, the vaccine has failed, but that's not true. Several studies show the chances of being hospitalized or dying from COVID-19 are severely reduced for people who are vaccinated. The oldest vaccine-making methods use either a live virus or a dead one to spark an immune response. Different polio vaccines have used both. Three COVID-19 vaccines use weakened adenoviruses, which are viruses that cause colds. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine uses a chimpanzee adenovirus that has been weakened so it can't make people sick. Sputnik V and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine use weakened human adenoviruses that can cause colds. The American Society for Gene and Cell Therapy explains how scientists make these vaccines. Scientists removed the gene from the coronavirus's spike protein and put it into the adenoviruses. They also removed the gene in the adenovirus that can cause illness. Think of the adenovirus as an envelope with a message inside. The message tells the cells to make the spike protein. The body makes antibodies to defend itself. If it sees the spike protein again, the body is prepared to attack. Both Johnson & Johnson and Sputnik V's first doses are made with a rare human adenovirus, AD25. Johnson & Johnson used to be considered a one-dose vaccine, but in October, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's advisory board recommended that a booster be used to increase its effectiveness. The second dose of Sputnik V contains AD5, an adenovirus people are frequently exposed to. Scientists are concerned that Sputnik V doesn't offer enough protection against COVID-19. There are other ways to make vaccines that do not use viruses or bacteria, what scientists call pathogens, that could cause disease. The latest method involves messenger RNA vaccines, or mRNA vaccines, which are produced by Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech. The side effects can include mild soreness, muscle pain, and fatigue. Rest, fluids, and non-prescription pain relievers should help. Cox says it's not surprising that researchers could develop mRNA vaccines against COVID-19 so quickly. COVID-19 isn't the first attempt at using this technology. There's an advantage of having so many vaccines against COVID-19. The whole world needs to be vaccinated. Hondurans are even willing to cross a river to get the vaccine in neighboring Nicaragua. Another advantage is that scientists might be able to figure out which vaccines work best for different people. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Negotiators in Vienna have resumed talks over reviving Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, with the United States taking part at arm's length as in previous rounds since the Trump administration pulled out of the accord 3 years ago. Hopes of quick progress were muted after a hardline new government in Tehran led to a more than five-month hiatus in negotiations. The remaining signatories to the nuclear deal, Iran, Russia, China, France, Germany, and Britain, convened Monday at a luxury hotel where the agreement was signed 6 years ago. The EU diplomat chairing talks on reviving the deal, Enrique Mora, told reporters he's feeling positive after the first meeting in Vienna.
There is a sense of urgency in putting an end to the suffering of the Iranian people. And there is another sense of urgency, too, in putting the Iranian nuclear program under the transparent monitoring of the international community.
That's the EU diplomat chairing talks on reviving Iran's 2015 nuclear deal, Enrique Mora. Thousands of migrants continue to wait in Belarus to enter the European Union through Poland, a crisis in the Central European country that has sharply divided the society between those who want to assist migrants and those who refuse to open their borders. Elizabeth Sheneff narrates this report from Ricardo Marquina in Warsaw.
Nurlab Mustafa, a migrant, he was one of the unlucky ones among the thousands of people who have tried to enter the European Union across the Belarusian border with Poland recently. Coming from Yemen to Belarus, he met his death due to cold, hunger, and exhaustion after finally having entered EU soil through Polish forests. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko's decision to unleash migrants across Belarus's border with Poland has sharply divided Polish society, whose more conservative sectors refuse to receive migrants. They have demonstrated in the streets to demand the deportation of those who have managed to enter Poland. Patrick Murnowski is part of the conservative research organization Ordo Iuris, which advocates for Poland's traditional culture.
It is not in an interest of Poland, it is not in the interest of Germany, it is not in the interest of the entirety of Europe to accept these people, which can pose a serious threat to our security and our identity.
Polish liberals have demonstrated in the streets of Warsaw, demanding that this crisis be addressed by putting nationalist sentiments aside and letting aid, currently held up by authorities, get to the migrants.
It's okay to somehow protect the border, but there is no compassion at all in their behavior and actions.
The organizations that help the few who managed to cross the police barrier along the border say there are many Poles who want to help the migrants, but there is also a sizable population who rejects migrants. Karolina Szymanska is a refugee assistance coordinator Ocalenie Foundation.
We're part of the people that say that we want to help and we do not agree what's going on there, and we do not agree for children, women and men dying in the forest. And there is a group of people who want to also protect the border, and they find those people as a threat for Polish freedom, for Polish states.
International observers accuse Polish leaders of choosing to ignore the humanitarian factor and focus only on the geopolitical conflict with Belarus and Russia. Marta Prokwitz-Jastowska is a political analyst and editor with the German Marshall Fund in Warsaw.
Poland and the Polish authorities are not viewing this only as a humanitarian crisis. The response has been very militarized, and the language that is being used, it's a language of attack, war, hybrid war, conflict. They are also taking into account what is happening on the Russian-Ukrainian border, where Russia has deployed 100,000 soldiers and additional equipment.
The migrants' crisis has a political root, the confrontation between Warsaw and Minsk. But their collateral damage is very real. They have first and last names, and they live in barracks in Eastern Europe, waiting for a resolution in the geopolitical conflict. For Ricardo Marquina in Warsaw, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
Guerrilla fighters gained international fame during the war against Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. They were praised for their bravery on the front lines of the brutal war. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Raqqa, Syria, though some soldiers say the military war may have ended, but there's still plenty of fighting left to be done.
In some ways, for Rojava Hama, life was better during the years of battle against Islamic State group militants. She fought with the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, an umbrella name for the Kurdish-led military that was the main frontline fighting force against IS in Syria. Hama says there was a clear enemy who she enjoyed killing, including here in Raqqa, the once de facto IS capital.
We were not afraid when we entered Raqqa. Islamic State militants were afraid of us. They didn't want to be killed by female soldiers.
Female fighters were instrumental in the defeat of IS, according to military commanders in northeastern Syria. And their ranks became famous in Kobani in 2014, when they fought alongside their male counterparts for more than 4 months before taking back the city. Now, the days of open battle are long over, says Hama. But there is still fighting to do.
It's not a military war now. It's an ideological war. Anyone can fight with weapons. Even children can shoot. But we want to liberate our minds from the ideology.
Islamic State sleeper cells still stage attacks in northeastern Syria. And when asked about IS, many locals in Raqqa are unwilling to comment, saying it is not a safe topic as IS could return to power. And in the nearly 3 years since the war ended, efforts to rebuild have waned, feeding the general feeling of insecurity.
At the beginning, building projects were obvious. But for the past 9 months or a year, everything has stopped. We cannot find any humanitarian aid.
Northeastern Syria is dotted with graveyards, memorializing the thousands of SDF soldiers who died fighting IS. And many survivors remain bitter about the fact that the Kurdish forces lost considerable international support after the fall of IS, a war in which they bore the brunt of the casualties.
We didn't win back Raqqa easily. A lot of our friends lost their lives. They were killed in front of our eyes.
In 2019, the U.S. pulled most of its troops from Syria, leaving the Kurdish forces vulnerable to attack from Turkey, which took over swaths of the border, calling it a buffer zone between them and the Kurdish forces, whom they call terrorists. Hama says the simmering border conflict and the constant threat of IS attacks keep soldiers like her busy nowadays, but she would rather return to the days of all-out war. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Raqqa, Syria.
Security is getting worse in Burkina Faso with the deadliest attack by Islamic militants in the West African country in years on civilian and security forces. People are protesting the failure of Burkinabe and international forces to stop the violence, with some calling for change at the top. Harry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Downtown Ouagadougou, early Saturday. Police fired tear gas into crowds of protesters calling for the resignation of Burkina Faso's president, Roch Kabore. Journalists were hit with tear gas too, even after identifying themselves as press. One local radio journalist was injured after being hit in the face with a tear gas canister. In recent days, protests have spread across cities in Burkina Faso. Demonstrators were angry at what they say is the government's inability to counter terrorism after an Al-Qaeda-linked terror group attacked a military outpost in the north of the country, killing at least 50 military police. Mamadou Drabo is a protest leader. He says we want the departure of Roch by noon. We want the resignation of Roch, his government and the MPP regime. By early Saturday, the police had blocked entrances to the square where protesters were due to meet. Some protesters began shouting at military police. Others approached them with their hands up to show their support for the security forces. Not all demonstrations were peaceful, however. Some attacked a pickup truck carrying members of a local militia known as the Kogluyogos. Others set fire to tyres and threw rocks at security forces as well as journalists. Maman Flora Pascalina is a Burkinabe blogger and activist who goes by the nickname Flo Flo. She says she supports the FDS, the Burkinabe security forces, and therefore Saturday's protests against the government. Flo Flo said her heart aches for the people who are dying before her eyes. She can't stand it, she says. I've thrown myself into this and I fight night and day for the Burkinabe people, for the F, she added. Protests against French military intervention in Burkina Faso have also taken place in the last 10 days. Demonstrators blocked a French convoy travelling through the country, claiming the soldiers were aiding terrorists. Many Burkinabes believe in conspiracy theories like this, spread over social media. Starting Saturday, November 20th, the government shut down mobile internet for 8 days, in part to stop the spread of misinformation, but also to suppress protests. The government came under pressure from lawmakers about its handling of security and the internet shutdown at a special session of the National Assembly on Friday. The Defence Minister, Aimé Simpaoré, voiced support for the shutdown. He said, regretfully, some uses of social networks compromise national security and contribute to the weakening of our country to the point of making it vulnerable. Analysts say the threat of protests may force the government to make concessions.
Some sense politically that there was a need to concede something to some of these demands that people were making, especially the demands that were relating to supporting the security and defence forces and investing more and making changes in the hierarchy.
More demonstrations are scheduled for the 10th and 11th of December. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
From navigating shopping centres to government offices, South Africa's, quote, little people, unquote, said public spaces aren't designed to be accessible for them. One advocacy group in Johannesburg is calling for better support to help them live independently. Linda Giftash has the story.
Different, abnormal, and very small. Those are just some of the words Olivia Radebe, who was born with a condition that restricted her growth, says have been used to describe her. The 27-year-old says her late grandmother encouraged her to persevere with her studies and with living independently, and she has. But Radebe says she still faces practical challenges navigating life in Johannesburg.
You cannot ask help and not pay someone, you know, because I'm not on a permanent job, and also the money that I get from the government is not enough to sustain me to that certain level whereby I can afford to pay everyone and anyone. Like, it's a bit of a challenge. So in other words, I have to beg someone to help me.
There are hundreds of causes for restricted growth, the most common being achondroplasia, a form of dwarfism that results in short arms and legs. Radebe was never diagnosed as a child. Now, she says it would be too costly to go to a private specialist to find out. Radebe says she sometimes wonders what her underlying health issue is.
Because at a later stage, I might be having other complications. So if I was diagnosed earlier, maybe I would have known that, okay, fine, in 10 years' time, I should expect this, I should live like this. There are certain things that I need to avoid in order for me to have a long life.
Specialized health care isn't evenly available across the country. Parents have to look to big cities like Cape Town and Johannesburg to find the best resources for their children who show signs of restricted growth. Rochelle Peterson is a member of Little People South Africa and has a son with achondroplasia.
Hospitals in areas like impoverished areas where there's a day hospital. So a parent will go and take the child, but the nurses, the doctors are not aware of the condition that the child has.
Raising awareness about people with dwarfism is one of the main reasons why Pete Nell established the nonprofit Short Statured Persons South Africa.
We can share ideas and come together, and also that the public can know what we are about.
The 57-year-old says he struggled with accessibility and discrimination throughout his life. Nell says the organization gives people like him more power to advocate for themselves and their unique needs.
That's why they say nothing about us without us. You can't talk for us, we must talk for ourselves. Like I say, we must stand together and fight for our rights.
And the country, he says, is starting to listen. Nell's group met with South Africa's social development minister to discuss their health and reproductive needs that go unaddressed. He hopes it will be the first step towards bringing more support within their reach. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In other news, U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says the appearance of a new COVID-19 variant could slow the economy and hiring, while also raising uncertainty about inflation. In prepared remarks to be delivered to the Senate Banking Committee on Tuesday, Powell says a recent increase in coronavirus cases and the emergence of the Omicron variant, quote, pose downside risks to employment and economic activity and increased uncertainty for inflation, unquote. He added that the new variant could also worsen supply chain disruptions. In the past 2 weeks, other Fed officials have said the central bank should consider winding down its ultra-low interest rate policies more quickly than it currently plans. They cite concerns about inflation that has jumped to three-decade highs. Yet Powell remarks suggest that the additional uncertainty raised by the Omicron variant may complicate the Fed's next steps. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Last week's 10% drop in the value of the Turkish currency plunged it to historic lows, threatening an economic crisis. The Turkish lira has dropped 45% this year, prompting concerns that economic turmoil could further raise tensions over the presence of millions of refugees. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Many Turks looked on helplessly as the lira plummeted, as some scrambled to convert their savings to hard currency. International investors dumped the lira after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan doubled on down on his unorthodox economic policy of cutting rather than raising interest rates to curtail near 20% inflation. At one of Istanbul's main markets, many people fear the latest currency collapse will bring yet more inflation and further turmoil.
Of course we are afraid of price increases. One produce we sell for 5 liras could be 6 liras the next day. So this also scares the customers as well as the buyers.
I am saving whatever cash I have. I'm not buying anything that I don't need immediately. Because one cannot see the future, one cannot guess what the price of bread or other foods will be next month.
As Turkish economic pain deepens with rising prices and growing poverty, the country's 4 million refugees, mainly Syrian, could be vulnerable. Recent opinion polls found a majority of those polled want the refugees to leave. Animosity spilled into violence in August when Syrian refugee homes and shops were attacked in the capital, Ankara. A series of social media videos by Syrians apparently mocking the inability of Turkish people to afford bananas caused outrage, prompting authorities to detain those responsible for the videos. They are pending deportation. But animosity towards Arab refugees comes as Turkey's crucial tourism industry is increasingly dependent on tourists from the Arab world. Many Europeans are staying away from popular destinations like Istanbul due to COVID restrictions. Arab tourists are key to this shopkeeper's survival. Arab tourism is a valuable source of precious hard currency for Turkey. But that could be at risk if animosity against Arab refugees escalates to wider anti-Arab sentiments. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
New research by Australia's National Science Agency shows that climate change has driven a significant increase in bushfires over the last three decades. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Parts of the Australian continent are some of the world's most fire-prone areas. A new study by a government agency, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or CSIRO, has found an 800% rise in the average annual area burned by bushfires in Australia since the 1990s. The study said the overwhelming factor causing the spike has been climate change. There have been more extreme heat waves and a corresponding decrease in rainfall in parts of the country. Since 1910, the research stated that Australia's mean temperature had increased by 1.4 degrees Celsius. The study also detailed how the annual fire season has extended before and after summer into autumn and winter, while fire activity has increased in cooler and warmer regions, including alpine forests in Tasmania and tropical rainforests in Queensland. Pep Cannadel, the CSIRO's chief climate scientist, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the world's fire-prone regions must be better prepared for the wildfire threat.
There's a lot of things we can do, and we're working on a lot of new warning systems, increase the prediction capability so we can be better prepared before the fire comes. That's probably the single most important thing we can do.
Australian scientists analysed 32 years of satellite data and 90 years of ground-based research. They've warned that mega fires that burn more than 1 million hectares are likely to become more frequent. The Australian bushfire season from July 2019 to March 2020, commonly known as the Black Summer Blazes, scorched 24 million hectares of land. It was Australia's most intense bushfire season on record. An official inquiry into the disaster said that compounding disasters would become more common in Australia. It warned that hazards such as fires, floods and storms could happen at the same time or one after another. Authorities in eastern Australia warned in October that grass and crop fires were their greatest concern ahead of the warmer summer months. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
Has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Akpan Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.